Now, very briefly, if you can, sum up what was accomplished in the Philippines. And there you were without your wife. How did you keep?
Right. Well,
how you kept in touch with her?
I certainly.
How did you do that?
Yeah. But I got to the Philippines. San Fernando was on July 45, 30th of July. And it took a long time, maybe it's about a month to travel by convoy from where we left in California, Camp Stoneman, actually. We had to go as slow as the slowest ship in the convoy. When we got to the Philippines, we had to establish some base camp, of course, for the combat engineers, and then we had to clear a few. We had a few combat action in the mountains near the camp. I went to Manila only once to MacArthur's headquarters on the furlough we had there. There was very little to do for this outfit in the Philippines except prepare for the invasion of Japan. And that preparation for the Japan invasion was very, very strong, very rigorous. That involved a lot of loading of all the equipment into LSDs and landing craft and climbing up these rope ladders up and down with full pack and war gear. We were scheduled to go into an area near Kobe in Japan at a certain date, and for the third time in my life I lucked out. Because we were when the A-bomb dropped about a week before we were supposed to go in. And the Japs gave up. We were scheduled to be the spearhead of the I-Corps. And that means clearing the beaches with the minefields and all the areas which the I-Corps would then occupy and continue in land. It's like an expendable battalion. We were a separate battalion, not attached to any corps. We were scheduled.
Wow.
So that A-bomb saved my life. When we got to Kobe, we were the second outfit to land in Japan after MacArthur in Yokohama. Kobe is a beautiful harbor. We landed in the city which is across the Kobe, it's called Wakayama, which is an industrial town just like Pittsburgh, the largest industrial steel production center in Japan. It was all shut up, demolished, and in a terrible state. Our outfit was the first one in there. We established a beachhead. My company, the second, the motor pool, started to reconnoiter the area. We took a couple of jeeps and moved up into the mountain area, which is surrounding the whole bay. It's a beautiful countryside. And
Gesundheit. Thank you.
And the first day, first trip up the mountain range, we saw some blonde children, which caught my attention because I didn't expect to see. I haven't seen blonde children ever since I left the States. Certainly in the Philippines, you don't see any.
Mm.
And I didn't expect something in Japan. And they got close to them. I heard them jabber in German. And I think I was the only one who could understand them in my outfit. In the whole army, they didn't have German interpreters in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that we hit on a German mission, which is was training the Japanese flyers to use Messerschmitts German equipment. And all the Germans who were in Japan were, of course, interned. The men all had fled just 2 days before. When the Japs gave up, the German fled. by a submarine. They had transport submarines and left their families behind because they figured that the American army will not do much with the German with the wives and children, but if they're military personnel, I mean, they would, of course, bring him in here as war, as prisoner of war. So we interviewed, I was assigned temporarily to G2 and interviewed some of the wives and children. And then soon the general staff got some additional professional interrogators and German-speaking people from the States, and I went back to my motor pool. I was there for, when did we come back? Left Japan December 45. Left Japan December 45, 29th of December, celebrated Christmas, New Year on the boat. And I got out in January, middle of January, 86, from Fort Dix.
Discharged.
So I was in the war, war Pearl Harbor, and after VJ Day.
Mm-hmm.
Got out after VJ Day. Almost 5 years, and another scratch on my, which was very lucky. The Princeton professors who saw me off when I finished the course said, when you come back from the army, come back to Princeton, you'll always have a place here, because they cannot give me degrees during the army, but I finished, during my army years, I finished graduate work, really, but they couldn't give any degrees for the army. The Navy got degrees during the service, the Army did not. So I went back to Princeton at the end of 46. And in 47, I got 2 degrees in June, I think. In March, I got...
Oh, I'm the interrogator. Hate to interrupt you, but is that where you hooked up with your wife?
Yeah.
Right? And did you... establish, did you live in Princeton then?
Yeah, we lived in Princeton, and she quit Hires. She was at Hires all the time, and till I came back from the army.
Mm-hmm.
And she went with me to Princeton. We rented a little room in a boarding house.
And how long did you live there?
Well, I'm really confused about this now.
Okay.
I lived until I graduated. But I don't know whether my wife lived there, whether Mia lived there that long.
Oh.
She may have come back to New York and started to work in another agency.
Hmm.
But Princeton was a nice little city. I've been there. Would you like to tell us how it was living there? Is that where you started your family?
Well, no. My youngest daughter was born. My oldest daughter was born in 1948.
Oh.
I was interested in learning something, and the captain from the separate battalion, who was a civil engineer, who also was discharged at the time,
mm-hmm.
went back to his civilian job as a manager of construction division of New York Life Insurance. New York Life Insurance started to build all these, a lot of homes and apartment complexes in Long Island, and they wanted me there. And I said I have to get a degree first. So. I had a degree in March 47, and Princeton said to me, Well, you have so many advanced courses that all you got to do is spend another term here, and you can get a master's degree. So I said, okay, I took some additional courses in material sciences, interested me. And I had a master's degree in 1947. And then the dean of the School of Engineering said, well, your specialty is really the specialty of why materials bend and break. It's a material specialty which is now called mechanical metallurgy or plasticity, or has different names. Mm-hmm. But at that time it had no names, and that was just interesting to learn about it. He said the Columbia University would like to have you check in with them, because they need a guy who has your background, and why don't you talk to them? They may want to give you an offer, professorship, instructor, or something like that. In the meantime, this captain wanted me to work with him on the
building.
Yeah. So I did work in the summer for him in a housing development in Long Island. Mm-hmm. And as a civil engineer. But I did check with Columbia at the same time, and they said you can get 9 free credits at 3 courses a term. You can take free of charge, and we offer you an instructorship in civil engineering. You can teach 3 courses, statics, dynamics, and strength and materials laboratory. And at the same time, you can get a PhD in a couple of years. So I decided, when I stay as a civil engineer, I know they all roam around. You know, they go to the Black Horse Dam in Montana, and to the water projects in Saudi Arabia, and building a railroad in Colombia. And these are good, well-paying jobs. Civil engineers were needed, but I didn't want. I wanted to raise a family, and I didn't feel like moving family around that much. So I told the captain that I appreciate his offers, but I want to stay with Colombia. And I stayed in Colombia from 1947 to 1952. And I got I finished all the work in 1952 for my PhD, but I got it officially only in 1953. In 1953, I my graduate work was in applied mechanics, which is a lot of mathematics, including hydrodynamics, aerodynamics, plasticity, elasticity, and a minor in metallurgy, which is solid-state physics and nuclear properties. So when I finished in my studies in 1952, I was looking for a job. What can I do? I didn't want to. They offered me to stay as an assistant professor, but I didn't want to do that. I heard that, it would be too long a side story. There are 2 professors who advised me for my PhD work. One came from Technion, was a refugee from Prague, actually. He was a great guy named Freudenthal, who became a full professor in Colombia, teaching the subject which they hired me for, actually. Mm-hmm. But he was certainly better, longer in this field. He was one of my advisors, and the second advisor was a professor who came from Carnegie Mellon. At that time it was University of
Carnegie Institute.
Yeah, Carnegie Institute.
Right.
And his name is Gensimer. He was the first mechanical metallurgist in the world, really. Very practical guy. Hardly any theory. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whenever it came to any mathematical formula, he asked me to come and explain it to him. Into the class. But they were wonderful professors. And as I finished my PhD work with Gensimer, he had his friends coming from Pittsburgh to see whether he has any graduate students who can work for the people here. One day I was in his office, and a fellow named Bill Johnston came in to see him. Turned out to be Bill Johnston was a PhD mathematician who was in charge of one of the big projects Edmund Rickhofer was doing here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, this was with Westinghouse.
Yeah, Bettis, yeah, with Westinghouse. Mm-hmm. And he talked against him and said, I need a mechanical metallurgist, somebody who can understand mathematics and somebody who understands materials and can deal with these crazy new materials which we need in a nuclear navy. And Gensimer points to me and said, that's the guy for you. So I became known to Admiral Rickhofer's people, and Admiral Rickhofer, who is the father of the nuclear navy, had two installations. He had Bettis here, operated by Westinghouse, and Capel, operated by General Electric in Schenectady. Mm-hmm. They both asked me to come for interviews. And Bettis did such a good job in inviting my wife and taking off a day and showing them all the goodies in Pittsburgh and the kosher delicatessen and the kosher butcher on Mary Avenue. Uh-huh. So then we decided to come to Pittsburgh. In 1953, we moved to Pittsburgh.
Wow.
And I became supervisor of mechanical metallurgy for Edmund Rickhofer.
You got to know Zalman Shapiro then.
Yeah. I'll tell you about Zalman Shapiro.
We interviewed him when? Oh. Yeah, yes, go on. So did you work on the nuclear summary?
I worked on the materials, mm-hmm. which go into nuclear submarines. In particular, into the core, the nuclear reactor core. Mm-hmm. And I wrote many, many technical papers.
And did you work under
Ben Lasker?
Oh.
How long was your career with Westinghouse?
Well, from 53 to 57. Actually, 52. I started with Westinghouse in 52. I didn't have my PhD, my degree, but I was finished.
Yeah, the famous Rickhofer. So you worked with Rickhofer too?
Well, not
at any time.
Personally, no, not personally, but he
but
was
he
a charge.
Supervised.
Yeah, he was a
charge. That's what I mean.
The whole thing.
And he would come in and check you people out, so to speak. That's what Zalman said. He was a tough taskmaster.
Well, there was one interesting aspect of this transfer here to Westinghouse. They interviewed me, of course, in 1952 when Maxwell Gensimer pointed to me and said, here's the guy who can do the job for you. And when I got the interview and everybody accepted and they said, come to work,
right.
They said, well, Dr. Leader, you have to have a security clearance. That is highly secret work. So I said, well, I have no problem. I was in the army. I was never a communist, so what problem would I have? So, foreign born. You have to fill out a questionnaire that is a mile long. And I have to give three references. And I gave three references, one of which was a good friend of mine who I knew from Vienna, who was in the Boy Scouts with me, and who was getting his PhD in Colombia when I was getting my PhD in Colombia, except he was getting it in government, public affairs. And he did get his PhD. His name is Kurt Schell. And by the time I gave him as a reference, he was in Prague, behind the Iron Curtain, doing postgraduate work, you know? And this didn't go too well with the FBI. Okay, so the FBI didn't give me a clearance. Westinghouse wanted me to start working here in Pittsburgh. It was in 1952. They said, well, we hired you, we are paying your salary, but you can't come to the place here. You don't let in, you can't go through the door there, you know?
How then?
In the meantime, since you're still living in New York, why don't you start working in Bloomfield, New Jersey, which is Westinghouse Lamp Division. At that time, they still made lamps there. Mm-hmm. And the lamp division in Bloomfield had a very interesting laboratory, which during the war produced practically all the uranium, basic uranium, which later was used in the stadium in Chicago and so forth.
Oh.
They did the materials work there. And they also had some very fine equipment and machinery to test these crazy new metals which are just coming in, niobium, neptunium, and molybdenum, and all the other, zirconium, hafnium. That was just ideal for me to get used to strange materials, and I was interested in mechanical properties per se, not in steel alone. So I got to work in this laboratory there. Westinghouse here paid me the salary. Every once in a while, they ask me to come out for just a discussion to tell them what I'm doing and where the clearance stands are. Mm-hmm. I did good work. I published quite a few papers, unclassified. And the laboratories want me to stay there. They said, no, we won't let you go to Pittsburgh. If you do work here, stay here with us. In the meantime, the management here in Bettis, and Zal was already working for them, needed what I could offer them. And the general manager, his name was Bill Shuppy, not Jewish, but very friendly to Jewish scientists he had there. There were many there. Finally got fed up, and he called Washington, and he told the FBI people, and he said, piss or get off the pot, you know. You interview him, tell me whether he can come to us or can't come to us, but we can pay his salary forever and don't get his services. So sure enough, a week later I got a call to report down to the FBI headquarters in Houston and in New York. And there was a reporter there, and there was the director from the FBI with a recording machine. At that time they didn't have these tapes, they had these records. And he took, he interviewed me for three and a half hours, and he got everything on the record that he could, can possibly imagine.
Just what we got out of that.
And finally, a month later, they cleared me and I could start.
Good. Tell me, what was happening with your wife during this period?
Well, she was in New York.
Yeah.
We moved into In 53, we moved in. Our oldest child, Carrie, was born in May 48. I remember that because it's the birth of Israel, just a few days before.
Where were you located there?
And at that time we still lived with my in-laws. It was with Mr. and Mrs. Weiner on Audubon Avenue, 228 Audubon Avenue, New York. We lived there till 1950. In other words, for 2 years, Carrie, that's my oldest daughter, lived with us in a room. We had one room
in New York. Yeah.
Then, mm-hmm. as I got some pay from the university as an instructor, and Mia made some money as a social worker with Hyers. We could afford a small apartment on very hard to get the apartment at the time. So 720 West 173rd Street. It's also in Washington Heights, not very far from where my in-laws lived.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember they had to use a trick to get this apartment. Very hard to get apartments at that time. There was a ground floor apartment with a separate entrance, where the it's below ground floor, so it's sort of a basement apartment, mm-hmm. and an apartment house with a separate entrance facing a park, which was very, very desirable for us because we wanted to take the baby out and take it to the park right across the street. But it, the owner of this apartment, of the apartment house, was down on Fifth Avenue, Park Avenue, some rich neighborhood. And,
yeah.
And I tried to convince her to rent to us by going up to her and telling her that I'm a doctor.
Yeah, that's not bad.
I didn't tell her that I'm not an MD. I was just
sure.
I was a doctor and I needed a professional apartment. And this was a professional apartment, you know, like a dentist would walk in an apartment. You have rooms for the
patients
in the waiting room, the examination. So I think I convinced her anyway. And we got this apartment, and we stayed there till from January 52 to June 53.
And then you moved?
And I moved to Pittsburgh.
To Pittsburgh. Where you stayed? You didn't move any more after that. This move?
Oh, no.
This was your last move, was it?
To Pittsburgh. Yeah. I stayed in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. All right, I want to get that straight. Because you have moved around quite a bit, you
know. Well, I moved to Pittsburgh, and but I didn't stay in the same place, obviously.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're allowed.
Yeah. But it was in 53. In other words, for 1 year, I already got pretty good income in New York from Westinghouse. And the commuting to Bloomfield was really something. I took
underground.
The subway to Wilson Street. Then I took the Lackawanna ferry
Well, that's okay.
To New Jersey, and then I took a train from New Jersey to Bloomfield.
You ought to be paid just for doing that.
Okay, we want to pick up with, let's see, you were at Westinghouse until 1957, and we don't know what happened after that.
Yeah. We have this much on the tape, if you can squeeze something good in there.
Well, it's a good time to stop. And then in 1957, Zalman Shapiro and Fred Forscher started a company called Numac.
Ah.
And there's another guy who came in with us named Petkovitz from General Electric. Uh-huh. And the three of us started in January. We incorporated in December 31st, 1956,
mm-hmm.
and I started the place out in Apollo, Pennsylvania in February 57. Mm-hmm. That is a new chapter in my story.
I'm sure it was. So that will finish this up real good. This company, just to finish the little bit, is it still in existence, or is it...
Numac, no, the company itself has been first sold to Atlantic Richfield, and Atlantic Richfield sold to Babcock and Wilcox.
Wow.
Babcock and Wilcox incorporated it into their nuclear operation, and it is not now known as Numac. It is the nuclear division of Babcock and Wilcox.
Yeah.
Part of the nuclear division, the fuel division.
That's very interesting. Do you have a question to finish this? Because it's going to go click any minute, any second.
I think this is a good point to stop. Mm-hmm. Pick up next time.
There's still a little enough to say something about something.
How long did Numac exist before you sold it? How long was it in your hands?
Well, I was there for 10 years.
Ah.
And Zal was there for, I think, another 2 years. And then it was sold to... I was there till it was sold to Atlantic Richfield.
Mm-hmm.
But it stayed as Numac in the Atlantic Richfield. I went back to Westinghouse in 86. Well, 68.
You had it backwards. I wonder what caused that. right, this is the longest ending I ever sat through, is that. Sometimes the tape will finish like that. This one seems to go on and on and on, and it's down on the end.
So, Bob, I think it's a good time to stop. Because
yes, I agree.
I'm going to stop it.
I agree.